him. Retirement, said Paul with finality. Coffin nodded. This was evidently the answer he'd hoped for. He paused again. Really, man, said Paul. How long do you have to think about whether you'd like to be the president of Edison General Electric? Oh, I'm not interested in that job.
Are you kidding? Asked Paul.
I'm not interested in running a company with the name Edison in its title. I would forever be drowned by the impossible legacy. You are turning down the most powerful position in the field of electricity because you're worried that the public won't regard you as the same haloed saint that they mistakenly thought Edison to be?
I never said I was turning it down, said Coffin.
Paul could see the implications in his smile. Oh, dear Lord, said Paul. You have demands?
Only one.
If you were to remove Edison's name from the company masthead, well, then I would not have to stare at the damned thing every day when I came in to work.
I cannot believe that a man in your position, after what I have just offered you, is bargaining.
A word of advice, Mr. Cravath? I have so longed for advice from you.
The moment you stop bargaining is the last in which you're ever given a thing.
Fine, said Paul. I'll tell Morgan. Call the thing whatever you like.
I'm sure you could call it Aunt Sally's Electrical Shop, and he'd be happy as long as it makes a nickel more in profit than its current iteration.
Thank you, said Coffin, as he plucked a pen from its cradle and started to doodle a few words on paper. He was testing out names, titles, legacies.
If we are agreed, said Paul, then the company is yours, and I will take my leave.
He turned to the door.
Coffin did not even look up, his attention focused on the scribbled names before him.
Hmm, uttered Coffin, as Paul's hand was on the brass knob.
Let's make it simple. Just lop off the first word, the one I dislike.
All right.
General Electric.
It has a rather nice ring to it, doesn't it?
Chapter 64. Nikola Tesla returns to Manhattan. Intellectual property has the shelf life of a banana. Bill Gates. 2 days later, Nikola Tesla stepped out of a carriage onto Lower Fifth Avenue. Paul was there to greet him. George Westinghouse stood by Paul's side. Paul had too much on his mind to notice the morning cold. Westinghouse appeared pained at the sight of the long-lost inventor. Or perhaps he was simply overwhelmed. Paul could not pretend to know how deeply he'd hurt Westinghouse with his subterfuge, or how profoundly Tesla moved him by descending, alive, from a two-horse hansom. Agnes followed Tesla out of the carriage. She handed a few coins to the driver before catching Paul's gaze. She'd gotten Tesla back to New York precisely on time, precisely as planned. She had been as good as her word, and her word was better than most. Perhaps better than anyone's. It occurred to Paul that this woman who lived with a borrowed name and an imagined history was the most trustworthy person he knew. Paul introduced Agnes to Westinghouse. Strange to think that the two most important people in his life had never met. Neither seemed to know what to say to the other. If only they knew how intricately their lives had been bound together. Tesla surprised them all by taking Westinghouse's hand.
"Hello, Mr. George Westinghouse," he said. "I thank you for your welcoming."
Westinghouse smiled. "I am glad to see that you are well."
"What is this?" said Tesla,
gesturing to the edifice behind Westinghouse.
"Would you like to see?" replied Paul.
The building at 33-35 South Fifth Avenue,
was a four-story stone behemoth just below Washington Square Park. They could see the arch two blocks to the north. This was some of the most coveted real estate in the city. Westinghouse removed a key from his coat pocket and unlocked the building's heavy front door. He led the group up the winding copper staircase to the fourth floor, where he opened a steel door. "Welcome to your new laboratory," said Westinghouse as he ushered Tesla inside. The laboratory was a wide-open space stretching 200 feet in either direction. It took up the entire floor, and it was of brand-new construction. It smelled of fresh masonry. Metal cabinets lined the walls, holding what appeared to be all manner of electrical components. Spools of fresh wire, zinc, steel, silver, lay in untouched bundles. Masses of rubber had been piled in uncut sheets. One cabinet appeared to be full of glass plates. The one next to it was fully stocked with tubs of what Paul imagined was silver nitrate. The photographic tools had been stocked along with the electrical. "This, Mr. Tesla, is the most finely appointed lab in the country," proclaimed Westinghouse proudly. He handed the keys to Tesla, who regarded them as if they were something to be dissected.
"You are giving to me a laboratory?" asked Tesla, his face expressionless. "I do not understand."
"We're not giving you a thing," replied Paul. "You paid for this yourself." Tesla looked up at him. "When you disappeared," Paul continued, "your attorney, Mr. Serrell, didn't know what was to be done with the $2.50 per unit you continued to earn in royalties from our sales. I told him that the Westinghouse Electric Company was more than happy to keep writing checks, but we were not sure who would deposit them. To whom could we even make them out? And it has amounted to quite a bit of money," added Westinghouse. "So we agreed with your attorney that your royalties should go into a trust until your return. If you reappeared, you could claim it all. And if you did not..." Paul trailed off. Left unsaid was that for over a year he had known that Tesla was very much alive. Tesla appeared immune to any implication of unpleasantness. Tesla began to stroll through the lab. He inspected the cabinets one by one, taking stock of their contents. He turned back to face Paul.
"I would have chosen copper, not your zinc," he said. "But yes, this is well."
"We assumed you'd want a laboratory as soon as you'd returned," said Paul.
"I have done much work in Tennessee," replied Tesla as he continued his survey. "I will continue it here."
"We hope so," said Westinghouse. Tesla took two glass plates from a cabinet and laid them on a table. He looked up.
"Screws?" he asked.
Westinghouse pointed to a cabinet in the back.
They watched as Tesla went instantly to work.
He found a screwdriver near the screws and a circular saw for recutting the glass plates. He began, without a moment of emotional reflection or even consideration for the other human beings around him, to build.
"Well," said Agnes, "looks as if he's of a mind to get right down to it."
"Do you think he likes it?" said Paul.
"I think for him any moment he is not creating is a moment spent thinking about things to create."
Westinghouse stared silently at Tesla. They were both most at home in their laboratories, and yet they could not be more different in their attitudes. Tesla was happiest when he was working. Westinghouse was happiest when he'd finished. Edison would be happiest only when he'd won. Paul was on the cusp of making sure that he would not.
"Mr. Tesla," called out Paul over the clatter, "there's another matter we'd like to discuss with you."
Tesla obligingly set down his tools.
"I have so much to do," he said. "What is it that would be helping?"
Agnes looked at Paul.
He had kept her in the dark as to this final part of the plan. He hated doing so, but there was no alternative. She wasn't going to like it. "The Westinghouse Electric Company is a few days away from declaring bankruptcy," said Paul plainly.
"I am apologetic to listen to that," said Tesla, as if he was struggling to discern the proper response.
"But we are in the process of securing a licensing arrangement with Edison's company, which, if we are successful, will no longer have Edison at the helm."
Tesla's brow perked up. This alone among human affairs seemed to possess some interest for him.
"And yet, if we go bankrupt," continued Paul, "it will all be for nothing.
And the cause of our bankruptcy, the reason that Mr. Westinghouse's corporation stands on such unsound financial footing, is me."
Paul stepped toward Tesla, his hands at his sides to suggest a subtle supplication. "The $2.50 per unit royalty that I negotiated on behalf of the Westinghouse Electric Company, that we have been paying into your trust, and that has purchased this laboratory, is not sustainable."
"Paul, what are you talking about?" asked Agnes.
He ignored her. "What I am asking you to do, Nicola, is to sign away this royalty, to give it up for the common good."
"The common good!" exclaimed Agnes. "What on earth is happening right now? Paul, come with me."
She motioned to the hallway outside so that they might have a private conversation.
"Let me finish," he asked of Agnes.
"Nicola," said Paul, "these royalty payments are soon to cease one way or another. Either we go bankrupt and you stop receiving them, or you give us this technology as a gift, and then we beat Edison."
"You ask that I choose this second path," said Tesla.
"If you give us your alternating current patents, we can beat Edison. And we can make AC the national standard. If you do not, then, well,
Edison will win," said Westinghouse.
"It cannot be so simple as that," said Agnes.
Paul motioned for Agnes to wait.
"If Edison wins, the entire national electrical network will be built on direct current. If you allow Westinghouse to go under, you will doom America to DC, to Edison, to a century of technological backwardness."
Tesla's face darkened. This was a serious and terrible consequence that he had not previously imagined.
"Paul," said Agnes, "I will not allow you to cheat Nicola out of his royalty payments.
I am not cheating anyone out of anything.
I am laying the case out plainly and in full view. He may make his own decision."
"Where is Mr. Tesla's attorney? I will get him down here this second."
"Mr. Serrell is unfortunately not available right now. He's in Washington, working on another matter."
"You got rid of Tesla's lawyer so you could cheat him alone?"
"I am not cheating anyone."
"None of my new devices shall function on the direct current."
Tesla was contemplating the dire future this posed for his work.
"If you do not do as I'm asking," said Paul, "the national grid of the United States will be based on DC. There will be accidents. People will die. This nation will be doomed to a medieval century. And the future you've seen in your visions will never take shape in America."
Tesla stared into a hazy distance, as if he could literally see all his planned machines evaporating into the air. These marvelous creations were there before him, hallucinations of chrome and wire, but they were vanishing.
"I care not at all about your money. But you must not let the direct current devour my world. I want only to build. You know this about myself."
"Nicola," said Agnes, "listen to me. Giving Westinghouse all of your money is not the way to protect your work. Miss Agnes Huntington, I cannot invent that which I must invent within the world that Mr. Paul Cravath describes.
We can stop that world from becoming reality, said Paul. If you renounce the royalty, we can survive. We can continue making alternating current systems. We can depose Edison from the head of his company, make a deal with the new leader, and live on. Both DC and AC can percolate through the country. The range of possible devices will be even greater.
Then you must do this, Mr. Paul Cravath, and I will help you. Not for your benefit, and not for Mr. George Westinghouse's benefit, and neither for to see Mr. Thomas Edison's fall, but rather for the future of these sciences. I have seen wonders in my mind. The invisible rays that can see through skin. A machine that can take the photograph of your thoughts. I shall build that too. These wonders must come true.
George Westinghouse had the good sense not to have said a word during this exchange. He let his lawyer do his talking for him. But now he removed a thin collection of papers from his pocket. He laid them gently on one of the laboratory tables and then took out a pen. He placed it gingerly beside the papers. "You've only to sign this," said Westinghouse quietly. He did not meet Tesla's eyes. Agnes's face curdled with disgust.
"Nikola," she said, "do not make this deal. I know that it seems like only money to you right now, but what source of income will you have if you give away your royalties? You will watch in penury as your peers grow rich."
Tesla smiled at her sympathetically.
"My ideas for the alternating current are old. If in the future I want for money, I shall have so many more ideas from which to farm fortune."
He came toward the table that bore the contract and took the pen in his hand. Agnes gave Paul a look of such violence as he had never seen before. He had known this was coming. He'd even reasoned that her anger would be a relief. What would it matter, he'd thought, if she blamed him for doing what needed to be done? She would never have to love him as if he were her fiancé. Wouldn't they both be better off if she didn't? She was soon to be married. And with any luck, her hatred would only help them to forget each other. And yet now that he was confronted with her withering gaze, the sting was so much worse than he'd imagined. She turned her glare to Westinghouse.
"You're a co-conspirator in this villainy?"
Westinghouse said nothing. He did not appear to feel a need to justify his actions to some singer.
"God damn you both," said Agnes.
She marched angrily from the lab. She slammed the door behind her. Paul wanted to follow. He had to explain. Surely she could understand the occasional need for well-intentioned deception. But he couldn't leave until the job was finished. In a few moments, Tesla scribbled his name at the bottom of the page. He had given over his patents freely and without compensation. They were now George Westinghouse's to do with as he chose.
"Go forth,"
said Tesla as he set down the pen,
"and create my future."
Paul took a deep breath. It was done. He ran to the door. Chapter 65. Men and Women. In those days when the comparatively recent discovery of electricity and other kindred mysteries of nature seemed to open paths into the region of miracle, it was not unusual for the love of science to rival the love of woman in its depth and absorbing energy. Nathaniel Hawthorne. Paul caught up with Agnes at the corner of South Fifth Avenue and Houston Street. She had her hand in the air to hail a passing cab.
He'd thought he could bear the deathly chill of her anger, but now that he'd felt it, he was overwhelmed. He had to fix this, to argue his case.
"You are despicable," she cried as she caught sight of him.
"Agnes," pleaded Paul, "come back inside. Just talk with me for a moment."
"You thought me cheap, because I chose a kind man who happens to be rich. Well, let me tell you, Henry Jane is a better man than you in every way."
She was trying to hurt him, and she was succeeding. Paul attempted to take her arm. She batted away his advances.
"You just stole crumbs from the pockets of an innocent man who is too confused to know what you've done. That is fraud. You are a criminal."
Her hot words puffed into the winter air.
"Please let me explain. What happened to you?"
She searched his face as if she was trying to read his soul, but found nothing there.
"You were the one who told me to do whatever it took to win. And you were the one who believed more than anyone else that I could."
"Not this, Paul."
"Tesla will be fine," he said. "Look at what I've done for him."
He gestured to the building behind them.
"You manipulated him. I told him the truth."
"You've been planning this the entire time, haven't you?" she said.
"Since Bell's."
"Yes."
"And then you lied to me about it."
"It's more complicated than that.
You did not do this for me.
You didn't do this for Westinghouse or anyone else. Your need to beat Edison is so great, your own ego so consuming and cancerous, that it has devoured whatever was good in you to begin with.
You are no better than Edison. You are worse."
Comparing him to Edison was too much. He had no way of explaining to her that, in a way, he'd done this all out of love for her. To show her that he was worthy of receiving her love in return. She would never get to witness his daily adorations. At least she could witness the unimaginable success that his adoration had inspired.
"I had imagined," suggested Paul, "that you, of all people, would be more forgiving about the occasional need to craft the truth in the service of a greater good."
"What I told you in confidence, you now fling back at me to conceal your own immorality?
Is nothing sacred to you? I only mean that we have all done things of which we aren't proud."
She slapped him cleanly across the cheek. Pedestrians turned to stare. Paul's face flushed. And yet he felt the hot flush of indignation as well. Could she really not see this from his side? Could she not see how his actions were so much like her own? He had acted in the best interests of everyone involved. He was undeserving of her rebuke. "You're behaving like a child," he said. The words sounded, when they came out, even more condescending than he'd intended. "You cannot have spent as many evenings as you have champagne drunk in high society parlors and still be this ignorant about how the world really works." Tears swelled in Agnes's eyes. She let them spill and refused to brush them with her coat sleeve. She kept her pained face pointing directly at Paul's, forcing him to feel her hurt.
"Do you know," she said through her tears, "that I once considered breaking off my engagement for you? Because I thought you understood me. I thought you just might be the only person who did. I almost fell for it. But I've come across your type before. The cynical young social climber who infects the metropolises on either side of the ocean. Your kind mistakes cleverness for wisdom. Your kind mistakes high-class trappings for genuine class. You take such pride in being so very smart
And do you know what the saddest part is? You're actually not stupid, Mr. Cravath. You're just not nearly as smart as you think you are. Good luck. You'll need it. I sincerely hope that you win this. I really do. Because I know something you don't. I know that winning will not make you a great man. It will reveal that you're not much of a man at all.
And with that, she turned and walked away, leaving Paul alone on Fifth Avenue. Chapter 66. The current war comes to an end. We are called to be the architects of the future, not its victims. Buckminster Fuller. Paul forced himself to put Agnes's condemnation out of his mind. He spent the evening with his associates, proofreading again and again the documents that would conclude the coming deal. The coup had been arranged, and the licensing arrangement had been negotiated. All that remained was the paperwork. He was exhausted. He had barely slept since New Year's. His associates had gotten even less sleep than he had. From their warren on Greenwich Street, they marked up the ever-changing contracts relentlessly. No one trusted Morgan, and no one had any confidence that what he'd verbally agreed to would be reflected in the contracts delivered by his attorneys. It took constant vigilance to see that nothing devious had been snuck into a stray subparagraph. To everyone's surprise, nothing had. Either Morgan had been uncharacteristically honest, or else he'd simply decided the deal was beneficial enough as it was. Whether he'd been restrained by honesty or moderation, Paul would never know. The afternoon of January 17th, a weary Paul entered through the front door of 3 Broad Street. He had been fortified with 3 cups of coffee to defend against his 2 hours of sleep. There was a caffeinated twitch in his fingers as he marched to Morgan's private office. There was no longer any need for subterfuge. If Edison found out, it was far too late for him to do anything about it. Paul had come to Morgan's office to preside over the final signing of the contracts. It was not a crowded room. Only Westinghouse, Morgan, and a few of Morgan's attorneys were present for the end of the current war. Westinghouse and Morgan were both wealthy enough to assume a comfortable familiarity with each other, despite having only met on brief occasions over the years. Neither had ever been the object of the other's animosity. Now they were partners. The tall windows let in light from Wall Street, while on Morgan's great maple desk lay a single unlit electric lamp. It was a generation behind the present technology. It had been the first indoor electric lamp commercially sold in America. Not just this model, but this exact lamp. When Thomas Edison had finally finished his first working device all those years ago, he'd sold the thing to Morgan, at a price that he alone could afford. And now it rested here, an unused symbol of a well-known history. Morgan's office housed many other treasures, from Old Kingdom Egypt to ancient Mesopotamia. The world's first light bulb was but the latest addition to a few millennia's worth of riches. Morgan signed his name. Charles Coffin's signature had been affixed in Massachusetts at dawn, and the war was over. "Congratulations," said Morgan to the room. Westinghouse stepped back from the desk hesitantly, as if he couldn't quite believe it. There was a disassociative discrepancy between the magnitude of the event and the smallness of the moment. Every man present knew its importance, knew that what they had done would reverberate for generations. And yet here they were,
a few men of middle age, and one much younger, standing silently in a smoky office. Gabriel's trumpet went unblown. Westinghouse turned to Paul, his thumbs tucked into his vest pockets. He nodded solemnly.
"You did it," was all that he said.
But in his eyes, a great deal more was communicated. Paul nodded back. There was so much that could be said. Too much. And so nothing would be.
"We did it, sir."
Paul felt a strange sensation. He wished that his father were there. Erastus would never understand what Paul had just done, but he hoped that somehow his father would still be proud. With an unexpected creak, the office door opened. The man who stood in Morgan's doorway was tall. His gray hair was strewn haphazardly around his scalp. He wore a suit and vest, but no tie. The top few buttons of his white cotton shirt were loose, and his gray vest was askew. On his haggard chin was stubble. His face was ashen. It was Thomas Edison. Chapter 67. The Fall of Thomas Edison. I think if we ever reach the point where we think we thoroughly understand who we are and where we come from, we will have failed. Carl Sagan. Edison's lips quivered as he looked across the room at the men who had just taken his company out from underneath him.
"Thomas," said Morgan, seizing authority, "I hope you're not here to make a scene."
He came around from behind his desk as if to create a barricade between Edison and the newly signed contracts. But Edison paid no mind to the paperwork. He devoted the weight of his ruined stare to the men who'd done the deed.
"So it's true," he said. "It's business," replied Morgan. "I'm sorry to be the one to remind you that it always was."
Paul braced himself for Edison's uncontainable ferocity. He looked instinctively behind Edison's shoulder for the sight of Charles Batchelor with a firearm, but the office door revealed only a placid office outside. To Paul's great surprise, no well of rage burst forth from Edison. There was no anger in his face, no muscular tension in his posture. Instead, he appeared deflated. He looked as if he were held up only by some thin rod running through the center of his body. He'd been beaten, and he knew it.
"Please," Edison said quietly, "just tell me the part about the name isn't true."
It took Paul a moment to figure out what Edison was referring to.
"Blame Coffin for that," answered Morgan. "He was the one who wanted your name off the thing."
"He took my name off the company I built from nothing."
"Charles Coffin took your name off the company I own."
"It is my name."
He stepped toward Morgan as his plea became more direct.
"I'll make you a deal for anything I have left, but please don't take away my name."
Edison was about to lose unfathomable millions of dollars, and the part that tortured him was that Edison General Electric would now be plain old General Electric.
"I'm sorry, Thomas," said Morgan. "You have nothing else that I want."
"George," said Edison, turning to address his enemy as his peer. "You understand this. These men," he gestured to Morgan and the lawyers, "they don't. They've never built anything. They've never bent down and with their own two hands molded something that did not exist before.
something that no one even believed could exist before, tell them to leave my name in place. Our war, you win. Do you hear me? I will say publicly that you win.
He bowed his head formally, the salutation of a losing general to a victorious one.
The country can run on AC. You want everyone to know that your devices are better? So be it. Maybe they are.
But do not let them say that mine did not exist.
Westinghouse's expression was sympathetic.
They won't, Thomas, he said. General Electric is not going away. It's going to grow. If anything, this will burnish your legacy, not banish it. Everyone will know it was yours, I promise you.
Paul was horrified. Edison deserved many things, but sympathy was not among them. This was the man who'd hurt them both so much.
I hope they forget about you by the morning, said Paul.
A bitterness had been festering inside him for 2 years, and now, at last, it could be released.
You lied, you cheated, you stole, you spied.
You tried to kill Tesla. You almost killed me. You bought off the police. You bribed a state legislature. You paid off a judge. You promoted a horrific instrument of death in an attempt to convince the public of something that was not true. You would knowingly install an electrical system across the cities of the United States that would kill thousands per year. And those are just the crimes I know about. You deserve a punishment far worse than this.
The room was silent as Paul finished. He'd given everything to beat Edison. He'd committed his own sins to prove that Edison's had been greater. He'd pushed away the one person he'd grown to love. Now he had only his anger. It felt good.
Paul, cautioned Westinghouse. Enough.
I've done things that I should not have, said Edison. I won't deny it. But not everything you've accused me of is true.
Paul wanted to rebut this, but Westinghouse interrupted.
I'm sorry, Thomas, but you won't be forgotten. Your name will live on. I give you my word.
To Paul's great shock, both men reached out and clasped hands.
Thank you, George.
And for what I've done, I'm sorry as well.
You can start again, like the old days, just you, a hot iron, and a dusty laboratory.
Edison gave a tight, rueful laugh.
My God, I can't even remember.
It's not as if you'll be a pauper, said Morgan. You can hire a staff. You'll own stock worth a hair over $2 million.
At this, Edison shrugged. He turned back to Westinghouse and they exchanged a look.
Businessmen, said Edison.
It was Westinghouse's turn to laugh.
With that, Edison turned to go. There were no goodbyes, no acknowledgement that this might very well be the last time he would see any of these men again. However tired Paul felt, Edison looked twice that. He slunk out of the room. Westinghouse shut the door and the room was quiet. The victors were left alone to their silent spoils. After a few moments, Paul was the first to speak.
I don't understand. How could you apologize to him after everything he's done?
Westinghouse's thoughts seemed further removed from Paul than ever before.
I know you don't understand, said Westinghouse.
He placed a hand on Paul's shoulder.
One day, you will.
Chapter 68 Revelry. When you have exhausted all possibilities, remember this. You haven't. Thomas Edison. Victory felt strange. After brief, formal goodbyes with Westinghouse and the attorneys, Paul left Morgan's office in a disoriented state. Out of instinct, he began to wander up Wall Street in the direction of his office until he realized that Carter and Hughes would be there. They would be in the mood for a fight, as they would soon learn of Paul's various deceptions. Tesla's survival, the associate attorneys, the coup to dethrone Edison. It was an impressive list. Either they would be firing Paul, or he would be quitting, depending upon one's perspective. Carter would do a lot of yelling, Hughes would do a bit of scolding, and Paul would have to sit quietly until they eventually let him negotiate something. The formal terms of the separation. It was likely that others would need to become involved. Lawyers hiring lawyers, hiring lawyers. The snake litigating with its own tail. The process would be occasionally enraging and mostly tedious. Paul slowed his steps. He was suddenly placeless. He didn't know if he wanted to sleep, to eat, to celebrate, or simply to sit quietly in a dark room and stare at the wallpaper. For a moment, it occurred to him that he might visit his associates in their stuffy, sweat-smelling office. The diligent boys deserved a drink. He would finally figure out which one was Bynes. And yet it wouldn't be much of a celebration. The associates were not his friends, they were his employees. They were so like Paul in their aspirations that a celebration in their company seemed dreary. They would all have new positions in his new firm soon enough. Tonight, they could wait. Paul thought of the friends on whom he might call. Friendly faces from law school whose company he had long appreciated. But he hadn't seen any of them in months. This meant that a dinner would be spent catching up. There would be a ritual recitation of their respective affairs, trials, suits, parties, new women in their social milieu. Paul imagined a few hours, two bottles of champagne, and a fleet of baked oysters as he recited the litany of events that had been taking up his time. It would be a history lesson, not a conversation. What Paul wanted was a compatriot, but what he would get would be a congregation. He thought of Agnes. He was still angry with her, still indignant over her refusal to understand his decisions. Time would vindicate his actions, he felt assured. She would not need to forgive him. He would need to forgive her. She would be married soon enough. He hadn't been able to win her hand as a poor man. To become a rich one, he'd had to drive her away. The irony offended him, as did her throwing in his face the suggestion that he might once have had a chance to be with her. She was wrong. Men like Henry Jane would always have an advantage. Jane had been spared the burden of difficult choices. He'd never had to dig into the dirt for his fortune. He had been blessed with the luxury of his pricey innocence. Agnes told Paul to win, and then was aghast at what it took to do so. It was this train of lonely thoughts that led Paul to a dim alehouse along the Bowery. He had not intended on going anywhere so seedy, but he found himself beckoned by the noise from the thoroughfare. The density of the din made him feel appreciated, at home in the buoyant laughter of strangers. Paul drank 3 tin mugs of Brooklyn's newest batch of lager. All around were the shouts of men who'd come to work their mouths as their calloused hands were given a rest. The men could tell that Paul didn't belong, but they left him alone. It was as if they could tell that he was fit only for solitude. Cheers, he thought, as he tasted his bitter brew. To great success. The alcohol swirled pleasantly around his brain as a man slid onto an adjacent stool. Paul didn't look up at first, not until he heard the man call for a glass of gin. He spoke with a voice that Paul had heard only once, a very long time before. "What in hell are you doing here?" said Paul. Charles Batchelor paid for his gin with 2 silver coins.
"Mr. Cravath, I'd like to make you a proposition."
Paul nearly knocked over his lager. He felt an implicit threat of violence, and yet, as he watched Edison's right-hand man grimace at the poor-quality gin, Paul realized that Batchelor had not shown up for a fight. He had not even come to threaten one.
"Are you all right?" said Batchelor. "You've gone pale. Did you follow me here? Do you think I typically pass my evenings in places like this?"
"Why?"
"Because you have a problem. With which, I believe I can be of help. I will also humbly admit that I too have a problem, and together we might come to agree that the solution to your problem and the solution to mine are in fact one and the same."
"I beat you," said Paul. "I beat Edison. I can assure you that you will never in your life receive an ounce of my help." Batchelor rolled his eyes. He seemed to find Paul's earnest anger rather quaint.
"Come off it, will you? We're both professionals. This is business. Let's act like it."
Batchelor set his glass on the pockmarked bar top, twirling the rim with his fingers.
"Charles Coffin, your newly installed president of General Electric, is as crooked as an old screw. You know this. He's dishonest, unpredictable, and eventually he's going to betray you. You need to install an experienced number 2 at the company, someone Morgan can trust to keep the ship afloat. Someone who won't sell off the cargo mid-voyage the first time somebody makes an offer. I've been a vice president at EGE for years, and I know how to run it better than anyone."
He spun his fingers again, the gin in his glass swaying like the waves in a summer storm.
"I've gotten too far in this business to start again. I'm not following Thomas back to New Jersey, tail between my legs. I've tended to his particular lunacy for long enough. It's time I tried another's. Put in a good word for me. Tell Morgan to keep me on as Coffin's vice president, and you may both count on my assistance."
While many thoughts rattled through Paul's mind, the most prominent was a fervent wish that he were not 3 beers into his evening. Wooziness combined with exhaustion made clear thinking difficult. Was Batchelor trying to lure him into some sort of trap? Had Edison put him up to a late play revenge? Except that injury to Paul no longer served Edison. Nor would it serve Batchelor. The war had ended, and Batchelor's speech only made any sense if it was genuine. Yet the notion that Edison's man was coming to him with outstretched palms was too bizarre to comprehend. Paul wanted one night, just one brief and drunken respite, in which to relish his well-earned anger. He'd be strategizing for the next war soon enough.
"Go home," said Paul. "Come and see me in a few weeks and we'll see what I can do."
Batchelor seemed unperturbed by Paul's reticence.
"You're celebrating, I can see that. It's rude of me to disturb your revelry."
Batchelor looked around the alehouse. The sound of the workmen seemed to grow louder. Paul stared at his nearly empty mug. His loneliness was none of Batchelor's concern.
One point of caution, though, continued Batchelor. If we don't help each other, then I'll have to assume that you'd like us to hurt each other.
I do not want this, but it must be noted that I can hurt you a lot worse than you can hurt me.
What are you talking about?
This war of ours. There has been no shortage of casualties. I know where the bodies are buried. On my side, yes, but also on yours.
The accusation was bracing. But still, the break-in at Brown's, the lies of omission to his partners, the subterfuge surrounding Tesla, the eventual betrayal of his eccentric friend, they were still a pittance in comparison with those weighing on the other side of the scales. Paul wore his sins on his sleeve.
I've had to do some things of which I am not proud, but I'm not the one who electrocuted William Kemmler, who set fire to Tesla's lab, who spread lies in every newspaper in America.
Batchelor frowned. It seemed he was trying to gauge something in Paul.
I've been curious about this for a while, I have to say. Thomas and I actually debated it on more than one occasion. I guess you've given me my answer.
He looked Paul dead in the eyes. Paul did not flinch.
Christ. You really don't know.
Know what?
Who set that fire at Tesla's laboratory?
You did.
No, we didn't, said Batchelor calmly. George Westinghouse did.
Chapter 69 The Good Guys and the Bad Guys. Whenever a theory appears to you as the only possible one, take this as a sign that you have neither understood the theory nor the problem which it was intended to solve. Karl Popper.
That's not true, said Paul.
The night of the fire, said Batchelor. Westinghouse told you to take Tesla to dinner at Delmonico's.
Only you didn't go.
He suggested it because he wanted you both out of the lab.
Did you or did you not share the address Tesla gave you with Westinghouse?
He wasn't trying to kill Tesla, only to shake him up to bring him back into the fold. But the fire was much worse than he'd planned. You were hurt, Tesla vanished. His man didn't know you were still in the building when he set the flame.
For Christ's sake, who do you think pulled you out of the fire? Who do you think saved Tesla?
The police said it was a stranger.
Batchelor looked at Paul as if he were the greatest idiot on the earth.
You think some good Samaritan dove into the flaming wreckage and saved your life? This is New York. It was my man. I'd had him following you for a month. The Pinkertons are plenty tough. He ran into the building when he saw the flames. By the time he got inside, you collapsed. He got Tesla to help get you out of the building, but while he was trying to revive you, the lunatic ran away. The terror of it all threw the poor man's brain out of sorts. Westinghouse's plan had the opposite effect of the one he'd intended. Fortunately for us.
Paul struggled to conjure some bit of proof that might show that Batchelor was lying.
Don't make that face, Batchelor continued. You've never been good at playing the doe-eyed naif. In the end, you did Westinghouse's dirty work for him. You were the one who talked Tesla out of the royalty. You did more to doom Tesla with a compelling speech and a scrawl upon a dotted line than Westinghouse did with arson.
Paul felt as if he were looking into a kaleidoscope. As if all the colors in the known universe had been rearranged.
Even if what you're saying is true, how can you know?
How could you know what Westinghouse told me that night?
Surely by now you know the answer to that, said Bachelor. Reginald Fessenden told us.
The heavy air caught in Paul's throat. The bitter irony was that Edison had known more about the secret operations of Westinghouse than Paul did. All this time, Paul had thought he knew who the villain in this story was. Now he realized that it was him.
Speaking of which, continued Bachelor, would you go easy on the kid?
Fessenden?
He's a good boy. We conscripted him into conspiracy. I was his damned press gang. Pittsburgh has been hell on him. Miserable place. Worse than Indiana.
Paul was out of argument. What he had achieved was worse than losing. He'd won, and now he knew that he shouldn't have. He couldn't defend Westinghouse anymore. He could not even defend himself. Westinghouse could go to hell. So could Edison, Coffin, Morgan, Bachelor, the lot of them be damned. Paul already was. There remained only one person in this blood-speckled tragedy who deserved more than brimstone.
I'll make you a deal, said Paul.
Bachelor nodded.
Much appreciated.
He stood, stretching his legs. He'd gotten what he'd come for.
You haven't heard what I want yet. Pardon?
You want to make a deal? Let's make a deal. But first you should hear my offer.
You're still negotiating?
Yes, said Paul. The moment you stop is the moment you're never given another thing. Bachelor sat again.
We'll keep this all a secret, offered Paul. What my side has done, what your side has done, you have mud to fling at Westinghouse, I have mud to fling at Edison. I know about his connection to Harold Brown. I trust you're not eager for him to make another appearance.
Bachelor shook his head ruefully.
I told Thomas, told him 100 times not to do business with that man. This was always Thomas's problem, I suppose. Poor management.
Brown's off hiding from the mess he created.
Banished would be a better way of putting it. He's far from New York, and we've made it very clear that his appearance within 1,000 miles of here would not be healthy for him. I'll happily do you the service of not finding him.
You want Fessenden to join Edison in New Jersey? I'll see that it's done. Westinghouse wants him jailed, but I'll find some pretense to let him loose. You want to stay on at GE? Easy. But in exchange, there is one more thing I'll need you to do for me.
Bachelor waited expectantly.
There were many grand prizes Paul might demand for keeping his fetid secrets. And yet the only thing he really wanted would be inconceivably small to Bachelor.
We're all going to burn, said Paul, and we all deserve to. You, me, Edison, Westinghouse, Brown.
But together we might have a chance of seeing that one good thing comes of this unholy mess.
Oh? There is one person who we can assure is granted the justice that we've so thoroughly deprived each other. And who, Mr. Cravath, is that?
Chapter 70. All men get the things they love. Let's go invent tomorrow instead of worrying about what happened yesterday. Steve Jobs. Agnes wasn't at home when Paul presented himself on her doorstep the following afternoon. He rang the bell 12 times, but there was no response. Not even the maid came to answer the door. Number 4 was the stillest house along Gramercy.
Paul next went to the Metropolitan Opera House.